25. That night, Frankie slept well. In the morning, she found a closet full of clothes in her bedroom. Essentials. Smiling, she dressed in striped corduroy pants and a flowy, embroidered peasant blouse and drove down to her parents' house, where Mom stood on the front step holding on to a walker.
"You're late," she said,
looking agitated. "I'm not late, Mom," Frankie said, helping her mother into the car. Mom slid awkwardly into the seat. "I love the house, Mom," Frankie said. "Everywhere I look, I see you. I know how hard you work to make it homey. Thank you for letting me live there." Mom nodded jerkily, not quite in control of her movement. Frankie could see how anxious her mother was, how she gripped the console between the seats to steady herself. "Are you having a little vertigo?" Frankie asked. Mom nodded, said,
"Yes,"
in a way that stretched out the word, misshaped it.
"Damn it."
Frankie could count on one hand the time she'd heard her mother curse. "It will take time, Mom. Don't be too hard on yourself. The physical therapist will help, and the occupational therapist, too." Mom gave a little snort that might have been agreement or disagreement. It was hard to tell. In San Diego, Frankie turned into the medical center entrance and parked. She helped Mom out of the car and steadied her. Using the walker, with her knuckles white from effort, Mom limped slowly from the car to the lobby. Frankie checked her mother in and got them both seated in the waiting area.
"Scared," Mom muttered.
Frankie had never heard her mother even use that word before. "I'm here, Mom. I've got you. You'll be okay. You're tough."
"Huh."
A nurse came out and called, "Elizabeth McGrath?" Frankie helped her mother to her feet, steadied her as she used the walker to cross the lobby. At the last minute, she turned, looked at Frankie through frightened eyes. "I'll be here when you're finished, Mom," Frankie said, giving her a gentle smile. Mom nodded awkwardly. Frankie returned to her seat and sat down. Reaching sideways, she picked through a stack of magazines, found an article about the POWs still in Vietnam. It reminded her of the League of Families and their quest to bring the POWs home from Vietnam. They had been looking for an office in San Diego when Frankie and Barb had attended that luncheon in Washington, D.C. Frankie went in search of a payphone, found one, and called information. "Is there an office number for the League of Families in San Diego?" she asked the operator. A moment later, the operator said, "There's a National League of Families of American Prisoners and Missing in Southeast Asia." "That's it. I'll connect you."
"League of Families, this is Sabrina. How may I help you?"
a woman said over the phone.
"Hi, do you accept donations?" Frankie asked.
The woman laughed.
"Boy, do we. Would you like to come by the office?"
"Sure,
I have a little time."
Frankie wrote down the office address and walked out to her car. In the glove box, she found the Thomas Guide for the area, looked up the address, and started to drive. Across town, on a pretty little side street, she parked in front of a small building that looked like it had once been a restaurant. A hand-painted sign over the door read, "The League of POW MIA Families." She went to the front door, which was standing open. The office was small, basically unfurnished, except for a single desk that held stacks of flyers. A woman sat behind it. At Frankie's entrance, she looked up.
"Welcome to the League of Families."
Another woman was on her knees, her face covered by a cascade of blonde curls, painting a sign that read, "Don't let them be forgotten." She waved at Frankie, too.
"Hi there. Welcome."
The woman at the desk was beautiful in an exotic way, with long black hair and high cheekbones. Beside her, a toddler lay sleeping in a stroller.
"I'm Rose Contreras. Come in. Are you a Navy wife?"
"No, I'm Frankie McGrath, former Army nurse."
"Bless you,"
Rose said softly.
"Do you know a prisoner of war?"
"No, I'm just here to donate to the cause."
"We welcome all donations, of course," Rose said. "As you can see, we are pretty bare bones at this point."
Frankie opened her handbag, reached in for her wallet.
"But Frankie?"
"Yes?"
"What we really need is help raising awareness.
The older ladies, Anne and Melissa and Sherry, the gals married to the Mucky Mucks, they do all the public speaking and testifying in front of the Senate. I'm chair of the letter writing committee. Our goal is to write letters to anyone and everyone we can think of who might be able to help, bury them in letters, and the same with the newspapers. Would you like to help? Letter writing. Something she could do while she sat with her mother and made the family dinner and waited for Mom to finish her various appointments. Frankie smiled. I would love to join that effort, Rose. Writing letters on behalf of the League of Families and the Vietnam Prisoners of War quickly became an obsession. Frankie wrote when she felt lonely, when she couldn't sleep, when she felt anxious, when her mother was in physical or occupational therapy, while she sat in the waiting room at the medical center. She wrote sitting on the beach after dinner. She wrote to everyone she could think of, Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, Bob Dole, Harry Reasoner, Gloria Steinem, Walter Cronkite, Barbara Walters, anyone who might listen and help or talk to someone who might. Dear Dr. Kissinger, I am writing on behalf of our American heroes, the men who have been left behind. As an Army nurse who served in Vietnam, I know the horrors these men will have endured. They went to war for their country, to do the right thing, and now our country must do the right thing in return. We cannot leave any man or woman behind. When she wasn't writing, she was with her mother, helping her to walk, encouraging her to eat enough to get her weight back up, driving her to and from appointments. It was slow going, recovery from a stroke, but her mother exerted her considerable will and pushed forward, sometimes to the point of exhaustion. The doctors were amazed at the speed of her recovery. Frankie and her father were not. Bette McGrath had always had a will of steel. All in all, Frankie thought she was doing well. Her mood swings had diminished, and she hadn't suffered through a Vietnam nightmare in weeks, had never yet wakened on her bungalow's bedroom floor. Every other Sunday, she wrote to Barb and Ethel, and she received regular letters in return. With long-distance phone charges so exorbitant, they had to make do with letters. It didn't bother her, although it bothered her mother, that she had no real social life and hadn't been on a date since, well, before Vietnam. Love was the last thing on her mind. All she wanted was peace and quiet. By late June 1971, nearly 2 months after she'd moved home, Frankie had settled into a steady routine. Helping her mother's recovery gave her satisfaction, and writing letters on behalf of the prisoners of war gave her purpose. But today, finally, she had been invited to do more than just write letters. In mid-afternoon, she parked her car at the Chula Vista Outdoor Shopping Center and headed for the escalators. The shopping center was decorated in red, white, and blue bunting for the upcoming holiday weekend, and most of the storefronts were advertising a sale of some kind. In the courtyard, beneath a palm tree, a table had been set up. Behind it sat a pert, pretty young woman who wore her teased blonde hair in two low ponytails. She was writing a letter. To her left was a crude bamboo cage, not nearly big enough for a man to stand upright in. A banner around the cage read, "Don't let them be forgotten." Frankie smiled and slid into the empty seat. "I'm Frankie," she said, extending her hand. The woman shook it.
"Joan, how is it going today?"
"Slow. People are getting ready for the holiday."
Frankie straightened the stack of flyers in front of her. In the center of the table was a box of POW bracelets that sold for $5 apiece. Joan went back to her letter.
"Do you think 'live up to your damn promise, President Nixon' is too aggressive for the first sentence?"
she asked Frankie, poising her pen tip just above the paper.
"I don't think you can be too aggressive," Frankie said, taking out a piece of paper and a pen.
A young man with long hair and a bushy beard walked past their table, muttered "warmongers" under his breath, and kept walking.
"Freedom isn't free, asshole," Frankie yelled. "How come you aren't in Canada?"
"We aren't supposed to yell at the peaceniks," Joan said, grinning. "But what a stupid rule."
"It's more of a guideline," Frankie said.
Joan laughed.
"How long has your husband been a POW?"
"I'm not married.
My brother and several friends died over there. Your husband?
Shot down in 69. He's in Wallow.
I'm sorry, Joan. Kids?
Just one. A girl. Charlotte. She doesn't remember her dad.
Frankie touched the woman's hand. They were about the same age, living very different lives, but the war connected them.
He'll come home, Joan.
A dark-haired woman in a black and white plaid pantsuit neared the table.
They put our soldiers in cages like that? Really? Where they don't have enough room to stand up?
Yes, ma'am.
What did they do?
Do?
Joan asked.
To end up in cages. Are they like that Lieutenant Callie from Mili?
Stay calm. Educate, don't annihilate. They served their country, Frankie said. Just like their fathers and grandfathers, they did as the country asked in wartime, and they were taken prisoner by the enemy. The woman frowned, picked a nickel-plated bracelet out of the box, read the name on it.
That's someone's son, ma'am. Someone's husband, Frankie said.
And they're waiting for him to come home. She paused.
This woman's husband is in their prison.
The woman pulled a $5 bill out of her worn billfold and handed it to Frankie, and then put the bracelet back in the box.
The idea is that you wear the bracelet until he comes home, Joan said, to keep his memory alive.
The woman retrieved the bracelet, fitted on her wrist, stared down at it.
Thank you,
Frankie said. The woman nodded and walked away. For the next half an hour, Frankie and Joan handed out flyers, sold bracelets, and wrote letters. Frankie was halfway through her latest letter to Ben Bradley when she felt Joan poke her elbow into her side.
Incoming,
Joan whispered. Frankie looked up, saw two men walking toward their table. No, not two men, or not really. A man and a boy, father and son, maybe. The man was tall and thin, with graying shoulder-length hair and a mustache. He wore a black Grateful Dead t-shirt and ragged jeans and sandals. The boy beside him, 16, maybe 17, was pumped up with muscles and wore an Annapolis sweatshirt. He was clean-shaven, and his hair was 1950s short. They stopped in front of the table, beneath the Don't Let Them Be Forgotten banner. The older man stepped closer.
Still fighting for the cause, I see. Frankie McGrath, right? Coronado girl?
It took a moment for Frankie to recognize the man she'd met at the protest in Washington, D.C.
The surfer psychiatrist.
Henry Acevedo, he said, smiling. This is my nephew, Arturo.
He turned to the young man.
You see those cages, Art? Take a good long look.
Arturo rolled his eyes, gave his uncle a good-natured nudge in the side.
My uncle is pissed I'm going to the Naval Academy in September, but my dad is thrilled.
My brother went to the academy, Frankie said. He loved it. My husband, too, Joan added. It's a great school.
I'm not in favor of a college that pumps out warriors and then sends them into harm's way, Henry said.
Just be proud of him, Henry, Frankie said quietly. He's making an honorable choice, even if you don't agree with it.
She pushed the box of bracelets toward the young man.
$5 if you'd like to help bring a hero home.
Arturo stepped forward, looked through the bracelets.
Groovy.
Do you know any POWs? He asked Joan.
My husband, she said, showing Arturo her bracelet.
He leaned in to read it.
1969, Arturo said. Whoa. He's been there a long time.
Frankie felt Henry's gaze on her, but he didn't speak. After a moment, he put an arm around his nephew.
Come on, future flyboy. Let's let these beautiful women save their husbands.
I'm not married,
Frankie said, surprised to hear herself say the words.
Will wonders never cease,
Henry said, as he tossed two $20 bills on the table.
Keep up the good work, ladies. See you soon, Frankie.
He led Arturo away, who pulled out from beneath his uncle's arm, obviously thinking he was too old for it.
Was that, you know, the guy who always plays a cowboy on TV?
Frankie shook her head. He's a doctor.
I don't know why you're still here, Joan said,
pulling out a nail file, filing a broken nail.
What do you mean?
If a man that foxy looked at me the way he just looked at you, I wouldn't let him walk away.
What? You think...
No, it's not... I mean, he's old.
Time doesn't mean what it used to,
she said. Frankie couldn't disagree with that.
July 27th, 1971. Dear Frank, greetings from blazingly hot Captiva Island. That's in Florida. Land of leathery people who drive yacht-sized cars and start cocktail hour at breakfast.
I know you were going to scream, as is Babs, who was getting the same letter.
Noah and I eloped.
I know you girls wanted to be at my wedding, but I just couldn't wait. We couldn't wait. When push came to shove, I didn't want a day that smelled like flowers and tasted like cake. When your mom isn't around, I don't know. I just didn't want that. But we will celebrate, and soon. Love you, girlfriend. Mrs. Noah Ellsworth.
26. 1972, and the war raged on. More deaths, more grievous injuries on the battlefield, more helicopters shot down, more men sent to Wallow prison or missing in action. Frankie, like most Americans, watched the nightly news in horror. Last year, the Winter Soldier investigation, a media event sponsored by the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, had exposed the dark underside of the war, American atrocities in the jungles and villages and on the battlefield, and Lieutenant William Calley had been convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the My Lai massacre. America had invaded Cambodia. All of it increased the anger and disgust shown to returning veterans. Sometimes when she watched the news, Frankie couldn't stop crying. It could be over nothing. Hell, sometimes she cried in her car when a song made her think of Finley, of Jamie, of Rye. Every tear reminded her that her stability was fragile at best. No one believed America was winning the war anymore. Even on Coronado Island, among the conservative, wealthy, Republican elite, doubt was expanding.
We need to be done with this, Frankie often heard her father say to his friends, as if the war were an expensive vacation gone bad. When her mother was improved enough to drive and be alone, Frankie was forced to reach for a life of her own, at least a semblance of one. She took a job at the Medical Center Hospital. Her education and experience landed her a surgical nurse job on the day shift, and once again, nursing gave her life purpose and structure, both of which she desperately needed. She made sure to keep busy. She wrote endless letters and manned the League of Families booth when she could, and worked long, grueling shifts in the OR, anything that would occupy her mind and make her tired enough to sleep. But she knew that none of it would help tonight. The 4th of July. Frankie dreaded the holiday. In the past few years, she'd remained cloistered inside on the 4th of July, with the music cranked up loud, just trying to make it through the loudness of the night. Barb and Ethel had always allowed her to hide out in Virginia, and last year, her mother hadn't felt well enough to host their annual party. This year was a different story. A party at her parents' house was the last thing Frankie wanted to attend, but she had no choice. Following 15 months of therapy and hard work, her mother was finally set to make her glorious return to Coronado's social life, and Frankie's attendance was mandatory.
I'm fine. I can do this.
She dressed in purple hot pants and a filmy white blouse pulled down off her shoulders, then ironed her now long hair down from a center part and put on makeup, all of it a camouflage. At dusk, she left the bungalow and walked on the beach toward her parents' house, toward the iconic red roof of the Hotel del Coronado. Lights twinkled from its eaves, lighting the way. All around her, life went on. Families, kids, dogs, shouting and screaming, people splashing in the waves. She stayed on the sand for as long as possible, then crossed Ocean Boulevard, which was buzzing with activity on this warm evening,
drivers looking for parking spaces, men unpacking trunks, women herding dogs and children to the beach, looking for a place to set up their chairs. The Tudor house loomed above the brick privacy wall, its mullioned windows glittering with light. Lanterns hung from the branches of the live oak tree. Red, white, and blue bunting decorated the food table and outdoor bar. Frankie closed the gate behind her. Independence Day had always been her father's favorite holiday. The family celebrated it in the way they did every social event. Full tilt. An Americana buffet was set up on the patio. Trays of barbecued ribs and juicy hamburgers, buttered corn on the cob, potato salad, and, of course, a tricolor cake with ice cream for dessert. Everyone brought something to the party, and the women of Coronado sought to outdo one another. The guests had obviously been here for a while. The volume of their voices hinted at copious alcohol consumption. She heard a man boom out, "Who does Jane Fonda think she is? Anti-American, I'd say." Off to the left, a three-piece band was playing a bad version of Little Deuce Coupe. Taped to the patio walls was a sign that read, "God Bless America and Our Troops." "As long as they're men," Frankie muttered. She released a slow breath, trying not to be mad or hurt. If only Barb and Ethel were here. Frankie hadn't seen her friends in too long. Ethel and Noah had recently welcomed their daughter, Cecily, into the world, and Barb was marching somewhere this weekend, gearing up for some top-secret VVAW event that so far she'd only hinted about. Frankie moved through the crowd, offering a fake smile to the people she knew. She heard snippets of conversation, well-dressed men talking about soldiers hopped up on heroin, bombing villages, and women in brightly hued dresses shivering at the thought of Charles Manson being kept alive. "Lock our doors now. They ought to have put him to death, darn liberals." Frankie concentrated on her breathing, trying to stay calm, until she reached the bar. Gin on the rocks with a twist. As she was handed her drink, her father peeled away from the crowd. He commanded attention with ease, as he always had. He flicked his wrist, and the band stopped playing. Frankie saw his million-dollar smile, the one that had returned with his wife's recovery. But there was a new shadow in him, too, a realization that money couldn't buy good health or safety from its opposite. He wore striped pants with a wide belt and a polyester shirt with large lapels. In the past year, he'd grown out his wide sideburns, which were coming in gray, and let his curly black hair grow long enough to comb over to one side. His new glasses were big and square.
"I want to thank you all for coming. As you know, our Independence Day party is a tradition here on Coronado. We first invited our friends to celebrate America's independence in 1956, back when Elvis's moves were a scandal."
The crowd laughed at the sweet memory of a different world.
"I don't think my daughter remembers a life before the McGrath 4th of July party."
He paused, seemed to struggle.
"But last year, we sent out no invitations. You all know why. And I thank you all for your letters and flowers. It was a difficult time for us, after Bette's stroke."
Mom appeared at the patio doors, her back straight, her chin held high. She had begun dyeing her hair to conceal the new white streaks in it, and that had led her to cut her hair short in perhaps the trendiest fashion choice of her life. With her flawless makeup and fashionable pantsuit, she looked as stunning as ever. She stepped cautiously over the threshold. Only someone who knew her well would see the slight frown in her forehead or the hesitation in her step. Dad turned, reached back, took hold of her hand to steady her. Mom smiled at her guests.
"It's been a long road back, and I can't express how much you all encouraged me. Millicent, your casseroles were lifesavers. Joanne, I still don't understand Mahjong, but the steadying sound of your voice stays with me. Dr. Kenworth, thank you for saving my life, pure and simple. And Connor."
Here she looked at Dad, then looked out to the crowd again.
"And Francis."
She saw Frankie and waved.
"You two were my rocks.
Frankie saw the way Dad tightened his hold on her hand, then kissed her cheek. The guests applauded. Someone yelled, "Hear, hear!"
"One last thing," Dad said. "Before we eat and drink and dance, I'd like to welcome home Lieutenant Commander Leo Stull. He's just home from Vietnam and Walter Reed."
He lifted a glass.
"To the men who serve, from a grateful nation."
Frankie slammed her empty glass on the bar. "Another one," she said, as the band struck up again, playing American Pie so slowly it was barely recognizable. "The men who serve, a grateful nation." She felt a surge of anger, downed her second drink, and looked back at the gate. Could she leave yet? Would anyone notice? Her hand was shaking as she lit up a cigarette. A grateful nation.
"We've got to stop meeting this way," a voice said.
Frankie turned quickly, almost stumbled into the man who stood beside her. He caught her. "Henry Acevedo," she said, looking up at him. His hair had changed. He still wore it long and layered, but the night's humidity had given it volume. He had obviously shaved for the party. There was no 5 o'clock shadow darkening his jawline. Long sideburns narrowed his face. "What are you doing here?" she asked, easing a step back, trying to steady herself. "This is hardly your crowd."
"Your mother and her junior league friends spearheaded a fundraising effort for the hospital's new therapeutic drug and alcohol treatment center. She invited several of us board members tonight."
He shrugged, smiled.
"You don't look like a board member of anything, and that's a compliment."
"It was either this party or my sister's out-of-control family in the suburbs."
"I would have chosen the suburbs."
Henry smiled.
"You've clearly spent no time in the suburbs."
Frankie heard the distinctive whine of a mortar rocket and the crash of its explosion. She screamed, "Incoming!" and dropped to the ground. Silence. Frankie blinked. She was sprawled in the grass in her parents' backyard. What the hell? She crawled to her knees, feeling weak. Someone had set off a firecracker, a bottle rocket probably, and she'd hit the ground. What was wrong with her? She knew the difference between a firecracker and a mortar round. Oh my God. Henry knelt down beside her, touched her shoulder with a gentleness that made her want to cry. "Go away," she said, humiliated. This hadn't happened since the country club years ago.
"I've got you," he said.
She let him help her to her feet, but couldn't look at him.
"Those idiots who get their firecrackers and bottle rockets from Mexico should be in jail," he said.
Was he saying it was normal to hear that and hit the ground? "Will you take me home?" she said. She heard the words and knew they sounded like an invitation, which wasn't what she meant. She didn't want him. Or maybe she did. She didn't want to be alone right now. He slipped an arm around her waist to steady her.
"My car.
We can walk." She led him to the gate, opened it. Ocean Boulevard was a madhouse of traffic and tourists. The wide swath of sand was crowded with families, kids, students, Navy personnel, all mingling together. Dogs barking, kids laughing, tired parents trying to keep their broods close. Soon they'd start setting off more of the fireworks they had bought just across the border in Mexico. Bottle rockets, M-80s. The sky would look and sound like they were under attack. On the sidewalk, Frankie kept close to Henry, realizing at some point that she had forgotten to put her sandals on when she left the house tonight. She had walked here in her bare feet. Frankie didn't know what to say to this man beside her, who kept his hand on her waist, a steadying pressure as they walked the few blocks to her house. There, she came to a stop. The bungalow looked silver in the falling night, the shiny red door, the white-painted brick wishing well. All at once, she saw it for what it was, a home from another era, for a different kind of life. Kids, dogs, bikes. It scoured her with sorrow, that realization.
"I'll bet you played on Coronado Beach when you were a kid. Probably rode your bike on Ocean Boulevard with cards clothespinned to the spokes. What a childhood.
With my brother,
she said quietly. She turned, looked up at Henry.
Thank you.
He gave a dramatic bow.
At your service, m'lady.
Frankie felt a surprising spark of desire, the first in years, a desire to be touched, held, not alone.
Are you married?
No. My wife, Susanna, died of breast cancer 7 years ago.
She saw the sadness he'd been through with his wife, an understanding of loss that eased her loneliness, or shared it.
How old are you?
She asked, although right now she didn't care.
38. And you?
26.
He had nothing to say to that, and she was glad. This, they, weren't a thing that needed words. Words meant something. She wanted this, them, to mean nothing.
Come inside,
she said quietly. He obviously understood the question, all of it, and nodded. She opened the back gate, led him into her backyard, which she'd meant to fix up and never had. Grass ran wild, yellowing in places from the summer heat and her lackadaisical watering. The barbecue she'd bought secondhand had never been used, and the oak tree branches longed for a tire swing. The backyard, like her life, was empty. She closed the gate behind them, and the tinny click was like a starting bell. He drew her close, pulled her into an embrace. She felt the power in him, the desire for her, and it made her feel the same way. Wanted. Something she hadn't felt in a long time. He drew back, looked down at her. She held on to his hand, led him into her bedroom. There, she let go, stood back, and faced him, wishing she had made her bed. There were clothes scattered on the floor, empty glasses on the nightstand. Had she drunk too much last night and stumbled to bed? She couldn't remember. He took her by the hand and led her to the bed. She felt like a virgin again, uncertain, afraid. Slowly, she took off her hot pants and pulled off her top. She wore a lacy white bra, white panties, and the gold St. Christopher medal Mom had sent her in Vietnam.
I've only been with one man, and it's been a long time,
she said, unsure of why she said it.
And I don't want more than this. I don't have it in me.
What don't you have in you, Frankie?
Love. Ah. I'm in love with someone else.
Where is he?
Gone.
He pulled her close. She softened in his embrace. Their lips touched, tentatively, the kiss of strangers. At first, she could think only of Rye, and what the kiss wasn't, who Henry wasn't. And then she lost her hold on that and felt herself falling into a new, slow building of passion.
There,
she said in a harsh, throaty voice when his hand moved down her bare skin, slipped inside her panties. It wasn't love, but for a beautiful moment, her body came alive, vibrated, hummed, and it was close enough. When she looked back on it, which she did often in that summer of 1972, she wondered how it was that she and Henry had begun actually dating. In her mind, they had never really started a relationship. They'd simply merged somehow, two people walking on different paths that had somehow, inexplicably, become a single road. It started that first night in her bungalow. Henry knew about pain and loss. After the death of his wife, he said he'd fallen into darkness, drunk too much alcohol, and stumbled. Frankie knew about that kind of stumbling, how hard it could be to right oneself, and how careful life needed to be thereafter. They were lonely, both of them, and brokenhearted. She saw the sorrow in his eyes when he mentioned his wife, and she knew her voice broke when he asked about Rye, about Jamie, about Finley. So they stopped saying the names. Stop talking about true love, and let almost love, passion, into their lives. Frankie went to Planned Parenthood for birth control pills.
She tried to feel modern and sure of herself when she walked into the clinic, but when the doctor asked if she was married, her cheeks flamed. She nodded quickly, then shook her head. The doctor had smiled kindly and told her she didn't need to lie anymore. It was finally legal for single women to get the pill. He wrote her a prescription. She and Henry met after work for drinks, and even sometimes for dinner. Henry was often busy with fundraising for the hospital and its proposed new clinic, and Frankie had no desire to join him at the events. Neither was ready to merge so completely into the other's life. Or at least, she wasn't, and so he didn't push it. Frankie didn't tell her mother or her girlfriends about Henry because it felt vaguely wrong, immoral, maybe, to touch a man you didn't love, to sleep in his arms for hours and watch him leave before dawn to go to work. But she couldn't stop it. After so many years of loneliness and grief, Henry brought sunlight into her life, and she was afraid to go back to the dark.
August 1st, 1972. Dear Frankie, enough is enough. Do you think I am an idiot? In case you answer incorrectly, I'm not. Your mother called me last night. She tells me that you're acting even stranger than usual, and you're wearing perfume again. I know what this means, girlfriend. Sex. Who are you getting it from, and how is it? Please tell a friend so she can live vicariously. Life in Chicago is good. Not lonely, never lonely. I am in constant motion. But it's tough to be a woman in a man's world, even when you're working for change. The next man who asks me to make coffee for the group or type up a flyer because I know how is going to get his ass kicked. Ethel, on the other hand, tells me that all her clothes now smell like baby puke and she can't remember what sleep is like. We all have our challenges, I guess. I'm going with the VVAW to the Republican National Convention in a few weeks. I hope there's no violence, but good God, enough of this damn war. Okay, I'm pouring myself a drink. The phone better ring the second you get this letter. Stay cool, sister. Love ya. B.
A hot morning in the third week of August, sun shining through a dirty windshield. Nights in white satin blaring through the speakers of Henry's Chevy Nova. I'm not sure about this, Frankie said, staring at the endless line of cars and trucks and motorcycles in front of them, seeing more in the rearview mirror. Vietnam veterans, mostly, but not all. They'd begun this caravan 3 days ago in Southern California as one of about 20 cars, but more vehicles had joined the motorcade in a steady stream. VW buses with painted slogans and curtained windows, battered old trucks, souped-up Camaros, motorcycles with military flags flapping from the tail bars. Now, over 100 vehicles strong, the group drove into Miami, honking their horns and flashing their lights, men leaning out of open windows to wave at one another. Henry turned down the music.
Barb asked us to do this.
Well, she asked me to do it. I thought I said no. Frankie crossed her arms, feeling mulish but trying to hide it. After a month and a half with him, she remained on her guard around Henry, concealed her irrational mood swings and inexplicable anger as much as she could. Otherwise, he'd ask probing questions that she refused to answer. He had no idea she still sometimes cried in the shower for no reason. In a park, they found thousands of protesters already gathered. Not just vets. Every conceivable protest group was here. Hippies, college kids, feminists. The VVAW group followed the lead car to an unoccupied corner of the camp, where they set up their own domain, which was protected by veterans with walkie-talkies who patrolled the perimeter. Frankie and Henry pitched a tent by their parked car. By nightfall, the VVAW camp was a full-fledged party where everyone was welcome. Wives, girlfriends, supporters, former nurses, and Red Cross workers. The leader seemed to be a man in a wheelchair, Ron Kovic, who'd been paralyzed from the chest down in Nam, and he called the upcoming march their last patrol. In the morning, Barb showed up, stood in the messy camp, and yelled,
"Frankie McGrath, where are you?"
Frankie saw her best friend and ran for her, almost knocking her over with the exuberance of her hug.
"I can't believe you're here," Barb said. "Where is Henry? He promised to get you here, and here you are. He must be a magician."
"He is," Frankie admitted reluctantly. Back at the pup tent, Henry was making coffee over an open flame. Frankie saw that he'd brought 3 coffee cups, and at that, a feeling that was almost like love, at least a watery version of it, opened up in her. He stood, smiling with the ease of a man who had a clear conscience.
"Hey, Barb, our girl has missed you."
Barb smiled, looked him up and down.
"I've met you somewhere. Washington, D.C., at the bar in the..."
"Hey, Adams," Barb said. "A fellow revolutionary."
"Time to go," someone yelled out over a bullhorn. "Remember, silence. We want those bastards to know we think there's nothing left to say."
The 3 of them moved forward, holding hands, merging into the crowd in the park. Leading the march were wounded veterans, men in wheelchairs, on crutches, blind men being led by brothers who could see. They walked up Collins Avenue in silence, more than 1,000 of them. Spectators lined the streets, witnessing the march, taking pictures. Frankie felt Henry let go of her hand. She turned.
"This is a veteran's march. I don't belong here, babe," he said quietly. "You do. You need this."
"So you..."
"Just go, Frankie. Be with your best friend. I'll be at the car when you're done."
Frankie had no choice but to let him go and keep moving with the crowd, her fellow veterans, holding on to Barb's hand toward the convention center where the Republican National Convention was underway. Frankie felt the power of it, their silence, as she had become silent about this war. They were the men and women who'd been there, and with their silence they said, "Enough." Frankie was surprised at the pride she felt in being here. In marching, in seeing the fists raised but the voices still, the thud, thud, thud of their feet on the pavement, some, like Barb, in combat boots. They stopped in front of the hall. The wheelchairs stilled. Riot police stood in a straight line, blocking their entrance. Within the marchers, platoon leaders gave hand signal commands. The veterans fanned out, quietly blocked 3 lanes of traffic. Someone, Ron Kovic, Frankie thought, yelled through a bullhorn,
"We want to come inside!"
They waited, silent, shoulder to shoulder. Frankie saw photographers snapping pictures and a TV camera rolling film. National Guard helicopters whirred overhead. The tension rose. Frankie felt a sense of danger. She thought all of them did. But surely the riot police wouldn't be set on military veterans.
"You might have taken our bodies, but you have not taken our minds," someone yelled.
A congressman came out at last to the cheers of the spectators. Frankie pressed up onto her tiptoes, trying to see the front of the line. The congressman escorted 3 vets in wheelchairs into the convention center. The marchers couldn't get into the building without risking their lives and creating exactly the kind of scene they didn't want. Frankie didn't know how long they stood there, packed in, blocking off traffic. But in time, the march that had begun in determination ended with more than 1,000 vets walking back to the park amid the cheers and jeers of the crowd watching from the sidewalks.
"They won't hear us," Barb said. "Not if we scream, not if we're silent. They want to forget about us."
"I don't know," Frankie said. "Look at the troop withdrawals. Maybe something is working." They kept walking.
"So he's cool," Barb said. "Henry?"
"Yeah."
"Why would you keep him secret? I tell you about every guy I even think about kissing."
"I have a flowchart of it, in fact." Barb hip-bumped her.
"Seriously?"
"He's just fun."
"Girl, you are hardly the princess of fun."
"He's helping with that."
"Do you love him?"
"I don't want that anymore. I don't think I can survive it again."
"Not all love goes bad."
"Uh-huh. This explains why you're married with kids."
"I don't want that life."
Barb put an arm around Frankie.
"I am pretty sure he loves you."
"Why?" Who drives a woman cross-country to make sure she marches in a protest and then says he doesn't belong? Kind of a kick-ass move in my book.
He's 38, already been married.
That's your answer to why not?
Frankie hated to tell Barb the truth, but she knew her friend would keep digging until she did.
You're a damn Wolverine, you know?
She said, sighing. Quietly, she said,
Rye, wouldn't he want you to be happy?
Yeah, sure. People said that all the time. All it did was make Frankie's loneliness worse.
That's what I'm doing, she said. This is me, happy.
The next day, the newspapers and news broadcasts were full of the story. Three Vietnam veterans in wheelchairs had rolled into the national convention just as Nixon was giving his acceptance speech. They'd shouted, "Stop the bombing." They'd been escorted out quickly, taken away by police, but the images made the news. The veterans had shouted so loudly that the president had had to stop his speech.
Medics run past me, carrying men on litters, someone screaming.
Frankie came awake with a startled cry and sat up, breathing hard. It took a moment to remember that she was in her house on Coronado, in bed, with Henry sleeping beside her. She reached out a trembling hand, touched him, needing to know he was real.
You okay?
He mumbled, not quite asleep, but not quite awake either.
Fine,
she said, touching him until he went back to sleep. Easing out of bed, she went down to the living room. On a top kitchen cupboard shelf, she found a pack of cigarettes and lit one up, standing at the sink. Images of Vietnam crowded in on her, demanded she remember. It was the march. All those veterans together, reminding each other of their shared past, all the pain, the loss, the lost, the shame. She wasn't supposed to think about any of it anymore. She was supposed to soldier on. Forget Frankie.
27. Nearly 4 months later, on her day off, Frankie pulled up to the Coronado Golf and Tennis Club and parked under the white portico. A valet rushed out to take the car from her.
Thanks, Mike, she said, tossing him the keys to her Mustang. Inside, the club was decorated for Christmas, from stem to stern, as the sailors in the club often said. Fake garlands lay across the mantel, studded here and there with white candles. A live Christmas tree shone with multicolored lights and golf-themed ornaments. Elvis's Blue Christmas wafted through the speakers. No doubt it was a scandalous music choice here. Several men in polyester leisure suits stood near the fireplace, drinking Bloody Marys. Mom was already seated in the dining room, which smelled of pine and vanilla. Behind her, the fairway stretched out in an undulating swath of emerald grass. At the white cloth table, Mom sat stiffly upright. She wore a cowl-collared jersey dress with a knit beret over her short black hair and long dangling earrings. Frankie slid into a chair across from her.
Sorry I'm late.
Mom flagged down the waiter and ordered two glasses of champagne.
Are we celebrating?
Frankie asked.
Always, Mom said, lighting a cigarette. I'm walking and talking, aren't I?
Frankie took a sip of the champagne and felt a spasm in her stomach, a rise of nausea. Barely excusing herself, she ran to the restroom and vomited. Twice. She went to the sink and drank a handful of water. She'd been sick yesterday morning, too. No. No. She pressed a hand to her stomach. Was there a slight swelling? A little tenderness? A baby? But she was on birth control. Could the pill have failed her? Had she been religious in taking it every morning? She might have forgotten once or twice. She walked back to the table, didn't sit down. Mom looked up.
You're pale, Frances.
I just threw up, twice. Mom frowned.
Are you hungover? Do you have a fever?
Frankie shook her head. Mom's gaze remained steady.
Are you being intimate with a man, Francis? Frankie nodded slowly, feeling her cheeks burn. I've been seeing him for a few months. And didn't tell your parents. I see. And your last visit from Aunt Flo?
I'm not sure. Since I started on the pill, there's barely anything.
You need to see a doctor. Frankie nodded numbly. Sit down. After lunch, we'll go to Arnold. He'll fit us in.
An hour and a half later, after an awkward luncheon full of things unsaid, they left the club and drove to the doctor's office on Orange Avenue. At the front desk, Mom said, "Hi, Lola. I need a pregnancy test." The older woman looked up.
"Are you?"
Mom waved her hand in irritation.
"Not for me, Lola. For my daughter."
Lola pulled a pen out of her teased hair and said,
"He'll make time. Nice to see you moving so well."
Frankie clasped her hands together and took a seat in the waiting room. Moments later, a nurse came out, collected Frankie, and led her to an examination room.
"Put on a robe, ties in front. Doctor will be with you shortly."
Frankie took her clothes off and put on the robe, then climbed up onto the exam table. Pregnant. The word kept repeating itself. A quiet knock on the door, and then it opened. Closing the door behind him, the doctor pushed the black, horn-rimmed glasses higher on his bulbous nose.
"Hello, Frankie. It's been a long time."
"Hi, Dr. Massey," she said.
The last time she'd seen the doctor, she'd been 17, going off to college, and he'd given her a sex talk that was franker than the one she'd received from her mom, but still began with, "On your wedding night," and she'd been so nervous and uncomfortable hearing about penises and vaginas from an old man that she'd barely listened.
"I didn't know you'd married," he said.
Frankie swallowed hard, said nothing. If Dr. Massey noticed her silence, he didn't remark upon it.
"Climb on up to the table."
Frankie lay on the exam table and fit her stockinged feet in the metal stirrups. The doctor settled himself between her legs. She stared up at the brightly lit white wall, squeezing her eyes shut as he moved her legs farther apart, scooted closer, snapped on a pair of gloves.
"This will be a bit cold," he said
apologetically as he fit the speculum up inside of her. He followed the speculum with a digital exam. After that, he stood up, covered her legs with the gown, and came around to her side. Carefully opening the gown, he felt her abdomen, her breasts. Then he covered her nakedness and stepped back.
"When was your last period, Frankie?"
"I'm not exactly sure."
"Are you on the birth control pill?"
"Yes."
"They're not foolproof, especially if you aren't conscientious in taking them."
He stepped back.
"I will run some tests to be certain, but physical indications tell me that you are indeed expecting. I'd say about 2 months."
2 months. "Oh my God, I'm not ready, not married."
He moved to her side, said softly,
"Catholic adoption services do a good job of placing babies with upstanding families, Frankie. Your mother will know all about it."
Frankie remembered a few girls from high school who disappeared from class and returned months later, thinner and quieter. Everyone knew they'd gone to a home for unwed mothers, but the words weren't even whispered. It was considered so shameful. And there had been rumors once of a girl from St. Bernadette's who died from an illegal abortion. Frankie couldn't imagine either path for her, not because they were wrong choices, but rather because she knew she wanted to be a mother, but not by herself, not as a single woman. She wanted the whole package, a husband, a baby, a family made from love. She nodded, sat up, touched her abdomen. A baby. She wasn't ready to be a mother. And yet, when she closed her eyes, just for a moment she pictured a whole different version of her life, one in which she loved unconditionally and was loved, where her present wasn't constantly shaded by images of the past, by shame and anxiety and anger, a version where she was mom. She dressed and walked out of the examination room. Mom was in the waiting room, sitting in that stiffly upright way that was her new normal, as if she feared that poor posture could cause another stroke. She looked up, met Frankie's gaze. Frankie felt the start of tears. Mom limped toward Frankie and took her by the arm, maneuvering her out of the office, across the parking lot, and into the Cadillac, where Mom immediately lit up a cigarette.
"You shouldn't smoke, Mom," Frankie said dully. "You've had a stroke."
"Who is this boy you're seeing?"
Frankie almost laughed.
"He's a man, Mom. Henry Acevedo."
"The doctor who wants to start that clinic for drug addicts?"
"Yeah, Mom."
"But since when?"
"Your 4th of July party."
She smiled a little.
"A doctor? Okay, so you and Henry will get married. A quiet ceremony. The baby will be premature. It happens all the time."
"I don't have to get married, Mom. It's 1972, not 1942.
"Are you ready to raise a child by yourself, Francis? Or to give it away? And what will Henry say about that? He strikes me as a good man."
Frankie felt tears roll down her cheeks. If only this were a different life. If this were Rye's baby, and they were married and ready for children. What will Henry say? The wrong man, the wrong time.
I don't know.
In the 4 days since Dr. Massey had called with confirmation of the pregnancy, Frankie's anxiety had increased daily. The phone in her kitchen rang often. Frankie didn't answer. She knew it was probably her mother, worrying about her, but she had no idea what to say in response. Henry knew something was wrong, too. He kept asking her why she was so quiet. She didn't know what to say to him, or to herself, or to anyone for that matter. So she just kept moving, got up, went to work, did her job, and tried not to think about the future that was suddenly frightening. Now she was in OR2, readying to assist on her last surgery of the shift. Christmas music pumped through the speakers.
"Happy birthday, Frankie,"
the anesthesiologist said. His long hair was barely concealed by his blue cap. Across from the patient, on the opposite side of the table, stood the surgeon, who peered down at the brown-washed, blue-draped abdomen. Bright white lights shone down on them.
"Thanks, Del."
Frankie chose a scalpel from the instruments on her cart and handed it to the surgeon before he'd asked. The doctor made his incision. Frankie blotted the blood that bubbled up.
"There it is," Dr. Mark Lundberg said. "Going in. Tumor. Clamp."
For the next 2 hours, Dr. Lundberg excised the tumor that grew in the patient's stomach. When the surgery was over and the incision sewn up, the doctor pulled his blue mask down and frowned.
"Is something wrong?" Frankie asked, lowering her mask.
"He's what, Frankie, 30 years old? How the hell did he get gastric cancer?"
He shook his head.
"Send it to pathology."
Frankie peeled off her gloves and tossed them in the trash. Following the patient into recovery, she went over instructions for his care with the nurse there. Afterward, she studied his chart. Scott Peabody, elementary school teacher. Honorable discharge from the Army, 1966. Vietnam. Married. 2 children. She made notes on his chart and dropped it back in the sleeve at the end of the bed. As she walked back to her locker, past the Christmas decorations on the walls, she realized for the first time how badly her feet hurt, and there was a dull ache at the base of her spine. She was, what, a little more than 2 months pregnant, and already she was feeling it? After changing out of her uniform at her locker, she grabbed her handbag and left the hospital. With the windows rolled down, she drove home, veering onto the new Coronado Bridge with Jim Croce serenading her about time in a bottle. As she turned onto her street, she saw a column of smoke rising from the chimney of her house, and she remembered that Henry was here to celebrate her birthday. 27. She wasn't so young anymore. Most of her friends from high school and college were already married, with children. Ethel sent so many baby pictures, Frankie had had to put them in an album.
She parked on the street and sat for a minute beneath a street lamp, staring out at the black hump of the beach across the street. It was time to tell Henry about the baby. She couldn't handle this on her own anymore. The secret was tearing her up, and the loneliness it caused. She would walk into the house, open the door, and tell him. She considered how to say it, turned the words over and over in her mind, rearranging them, trying first to soften and then to obscure and even to harden what she had to say. But in the end, it was simple, and she just needed the nerve. She opened the door of the cottage. The place smelled of roasting meat and browning potatoes. No doubt it was Henry's special recipe of chicken thighs, potatoes, and onion, browned in a cast iron skillet and baked in the oven. He was at the stove, wearing his favorite apron, which read, "Love means always having to say you're sorry," over jeans and a long-sleeved California Angel sweatshirt. "I'm home," she said. He spun around.
"Happy birthday, babe,"
he said, untying the apron, laying it over the back of a chair. He pulled her into his arms for a kiss. When he drew back, she was crying.
"What's wrong, Frankie?"
"I'm pregnant," she said.
His gaze searched hers. She had no idea what she wanted him to say. Nothing could make this moment what she wanted it to be. He was the wrong man, and it was the wrong time.
"Marry me," he said at last. "I'll move in here. Give up my lease in La Jolla. You'll want to be close to your parents."
He looked so serious, gazed at her as if she were the very center of the world. Exactly how a man in love should look at the woman he adored.
"Henry, why not? You know I've always wanted to be a dad. And this, love, it's a thing I'm good at. And you need it, Frankie, maybe more than anyone I've ever met."
"I don't
love you."
"Think I'm ready," she said.
"This is one of those times in life where it doesn't matter if you're ready. I hear it all the time from people. Parenthood is a plunge into the deep end. Always."
He looked so deeply, genuinely committed that it stirred her heart, gave her a glimpse of hope. People married for all kinds of reasons, in all types of situations. You never knew what the future might hold. He was a good man, true, honest, the kind of man who would stay, grow old with a woman, be there. And she would need strength beside her for this. She wasn't strong anymore.
"We could be a family," he said.
She put a hand on her flat belly, thinking, "Our baby." She had always imagined herself as a mother, a mom, but somehow her experience in Vietnam, that baby dying in her arms, had derailed her, planted fear where joy belonged. She was surprised to find that the dream of motherhood was still there, wispy, uncertain, afraid, but there, tangled up with the hope she thought she'd lost. It hadn't come the way she'd expected, or with the man she'd expected, but nonetheless, it was a miracle. A new life.
"Okay," she said.
He pulled her close and kissed her so deeply, with such love and passion, she found herself believing in him, in them.
"We'll have to tell my parents."
"No time like the present," he said.
He turned and shut off the oven, covered the skillet on the stove. Frankie didn't want to tell her dad this news, that she was in trouble and getting married, but what choice did she have? Pregnancy wasn't the kind of thing that could be hidden for long, and the clock was already ticking.
"I've got you," he said, taking her hand. "Trust me."
She nodded. Even though it was cool by Southern California standards, Frankie and Henry walked down the street, holding hands, not bothering with sweaters or coats. Cars rushed past them, headlights on. The beach was a vast, empty swath of black to their right, with a rising moon cut into the sky. The houses along Ocean Boulevard were decorated for Christmas, with Santas and reindeer and white lights wrapped around the palm trees. At her parents' house, they crossed the backyard, which was aggressively decorated for the holidays, and went into the house, which boasted even more decorations. A huge tree dominated the living room. Dad stood beside Mom at the bar, holding a silver martini shaker.
"Francis," Mom said, "happy birthday, darling. We didn't expect you tonight."
Frankie couldn't let go of Henry's hand. He felt like her lifeline.
"Dad, Mom, I think you know Henry Acevedo. We're dating."
"Henry," Dad said, striding forward, smiling that big, inclusive smile of his, the one that made everyone feel welcome and important. "Good to see you again."
"Dr. Acevedo," Mom said, practically beaming.
Henry said, "Could I speak with you a moment, Connor? Privately." Dad frowned briefly, then nodded.
"Of course, of course."
While the two men walked down the hallway, Mom sidled close to Frankie.
"Is this what I hope it is?"
"Mom, I have never been able to divine your thoughts," Frankie said.
It had never occurred to her that Henry would formally ask Dad for her hand in marriage. It felt so old school, so Ozzie and Harriet in this Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice world. Moments later, Henry and Dad walked back into the room.
"Bet, we will have a son-in-law. Welcome to the family, Henry."
Mom gave Frankie a fierce hug. When she drew back, there were tears in her eyes.
"A wedding. A grandchild. Oh, Francis, your whole world will change when you hold your baby in your arms."
Henry moved in, put an arm around Frankie, held her so close she wondered if he thought she wanted to leave.
"Welcome to the family, Henry," Mom said.
Then she looked up at Dad.
"We need champagne."
When her mother limped away, Frankie turned to Henry, put her arms around his neck, and stared up at him.
"Are you sure we need an actual wedding? How about a quick zip in and out to the Justice of the Peace?"
"No way. This baby is a miracle, Frankie. Love in this screwed-up world is always worth celebrating. When Susanna died, I thought it was over for me."
She felt his love for her, for their child, felt his dream for them unfold and take flight. It filled her with hope.
"I want to see you walk down some aisle toward me and hear you say you love me in front of your family and friends. I want a baby girl who looks just like you."
"Or a boy who looks like Finley," she said, daring to dream it. "I guess that means there's a honeymoon in our future."
"Baby," he said, "our life is going to be one long honeymoon."